Hi, I'm Ted Cook. I'm Executive Director of the North American Grouse Partnership, also Board Chairperson at Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, and a prairie lover, and this is the Prairie Farm Podcast.
I'm Doug Duren, a landowner trying to be a conservationist.
I'm Tabitha Panis, President of the Iowa Prairie Network.
I'm Ryan Callahan, Director of Conservation at Meat Eater.
Angela from Axe and Root Homestead.
Chris Helzer, the Nebraska Director of Science for the Nature Conservancy.
Judd McCullum from Working Class Bowhunter.
Taylor Keene, Founder of Sacred Seed.
Ryan Bryson of Bryson Wildlife.
This is Luke Fritsch.
This is James Holtz.
Joy Van Weingarten.
Sam Sobel.
Phil Ebert.
Julie Meachin.
And you are listening to The Prairie Farm.
The Prairie Farm.
Prairie Farm.
Prairie Farm.
Prairie Farm Podcast.
Prairie Farm Podcast.
Welcome to the Prairie Farm Podcast.
Ted, it's not every day that someone says we are working with the Biden administration, But when we reached out because we wanted an update, wanted to chat with you about an update, that's what you had said. So what does that mean? Because I feel like someone could say, oh, I'm working with the Biden administration, and they might just be working with their county Democratic Party, you know, and
yeah, yeah.
Like, what does that mean for you guys?
Well, great question. And the shortest answer I can give as of today is I'm not sure. But I can tell you our ambitions and our progress so far. So
yeah.
You know, the North American Grouse Partnership, we were actually founded 25 years ago in the basement of Tom Cade's house in Boise, Idaho. Now, Tom wow. Cade was the founder of the Peregrine Fund and saved peregrine falcons from extinction.
Wow.
And the day that peregrine falcons were delisted under the Endangered Species Act, there was a big celebration and delisting. Interior Secretary Babbitt and the Clinton administration came to Boise and made the big announcement. Next morning, Tom Cade got together with a bunch of his falconer friends, and they loved to hawk prairie grouse, right? So sage grouse, mm-hmm. Greater prairie chickens, sharp-tailed grouse, lesser prairie chickens. And they said, prairie grouse are in trouble. Let's form the North American Grouse Partnership. And here we are today, 25 wow. years later. Yeah,
wow.
Really cool heritage.
Yeah, right? that is a cool backstory.
And so we've been trying to figure out how to be effective and relevant ever since. And so, you know, fast forward to... When I retired, I was an endangered species biologist for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for 30 years.
Wow.
I retired at the end of 2018. Grouse Partnership said, hey, you know, do you want to apply for this job as our executive director? And I said, no, thanks. And here I am.
Yeah.
I can't leave well
they
enough.
Declined. You're declining. That's
yeah. Because when you're passionate about conservation and especially, you know, prairies, they're just so remarkable, right? I mean,
mm-hmm. yeah.
And if you don't know them, maybe it's hard to love them. But if you do know them, it's hard to not love them, right? So
yep.
Well anyway, said. Join the North American Grouse Partnership. We're really focused on the prairie grouse species I mentioned. And lesser prairie chickens on the tip of the spear, about to be listed under the Endangered Species Act. Now they are listed. And so we were trying to work with agencies, state and federal, to say, hey, let's get together. Let's go. You know, let's do something. And one of the federal agency scientists said, Ted, you're reaching out to us agency types, but 95% of lesser prairie chicken habitat is privately owned. Where are the landowners?
Mm-hmm.
And so I hung up from that call and I went to my bedroom and I cried.
Oh, no.
She's right. Oh, my God. So I thought, dang, you know, this is so true. Who
yeah.
do I think I am? You know, I'm some enviro conservationist guy. I'm really not. I mean, I'm pretty conservative politically, in my opinion, and all that. But I thought, who am I to fail to have even tried to contact landowners? So I started picking up the phone, calling people and agency folks and anybody I knew. Hey, do you know landowners of lesser prairie chicken country who want to conserve chickens? And I came across this remarkable group of about a dozen humans, all landowners in lesser prairie chicken country who love wildlife. They love chickens. They have multi-generation ranching families. And we got together and I called them up and I said, hey, we want to save chickens and ranching. And they said, I'm sorry, Ted, we disagree. We want to save ranching and chickens. So and so we yeah. formed the Lesser Prairie Chicken Landowner Alliance. And the other thing that we did at the same time is we had this group called the Prairie Grouse Partners with really smart people from Pheasants Forever, National Wildlife Federation, TRCP, Nature Conservancy, American Bird Conservancy, and Playa Lakes Joint Ventures. And they started advising us, what do we need to do to achieve our shared goals of saving ranching and chickens in Southwestern Great Plains?
How did you get these people's attention?
I called them up and I said, would you help?
Oh.
And here's the thing. When you've got the right idea and you demonstrate enough interest and energy, people want to help. But the real deal is the fact that these landowners are at the we've put these landowners at the forefront. And so this gets back to your question. Nick, I swear to God, I'll get to it. But what we've said, again, I talked to you very frankly and honestly. I said, here's the Grouse Partnership. We came from this background, this heritage. We really care about chickens. We know you own the land. If we're going to save chickens, it's only going to be with your support and cooperation. How can we work together? And we're like, well, we like chickens too, and we need this and that. And so so we formed this group, and then you reached out to the other conservation groups, and they're like, great idea. And I credit this. The gal's name is Beth Forbes. She's an employee with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. She's the one that asked me that poignant question, Ted, where are the landowners? And so here we are today, trying to muster our energy and our enthusiasm to carry this forward. So to get back to your question, we actually wrote USDA Secretary, U.S. Department of Agriculture Secretary Vilsack, January 31st, 2023, so a year and 2 days ago or whatever it is, and said, we'd been in communication with NRCS, Natural Resources Conservation Service, Farm Services Agency within USDA before that, and been getting good responses and help. Finally, we wrote to the Secretary of Agriculture, said, hey, please help us. And he wrote back and said, work with our NRCS state conservationists in the five lesser prairie chicken states. So Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, New Mexico, Colorado, and then the FSA executive directors. We've done that. We finally wrote down our very specific detailed list of asks for each of those five states. And then we finally sent a letter back to the Secretary of Agriculture on Monday saying, we've completed our task. We did what you asked. Here's our letter to your state agency leaders. We would like to report back to you and ask for your support for us to come together within this region to make the changes that we're requesting. And they're mostly changes that we think can be made administratively to how farm bill programs are implemented. And so we've gotten tremendous help from state conservationists and state executive directors with NRCS and FSA, respectively, from their staffs. We've gotten lots of support from career folks within the agencies within Washington, D.C., who are kind of rooting us on. We've gotten positive responses from Secretary Vilsack, from Undersecretary Robert Bonney. And now we're reaching out to those two individuals and others. Chief Cosby has been very supportive with NRCS and Administrator Duchesneau with FSA. But it's all been individual kind of one-off conversations saying, hey, I like what you're doing. Sounds good. Let me know. Well, now we're back. We're saying, we're letting you know.
Yeah.
We sent a letter to the Secretary of Agriculture on Monday. So that's what it means to be working with the Biden administration as of today.
That is amazing. I mean, two things that I heard in there. One, that you guys are the reason the farm bill is delayed. more importantly, it sounds like to have gotten a letter back last year that didn't say like, great, good luck, you know, but they actually gave you some homework, and then you just totally attacked it. When you were going through with this homework, was it pretty clear what needed to happen next? Was their letter, because I imagine their letter didn't like lay out, hey, here are the steps you need to do, but they were kind of generic lawyer jargon, and you're like, okay, we need to figure out, you know, how we want to attack this.
So this is the value of being a 30-year career federal bureaucrat.
Yeah, you know the steps.
Okay.
But really, I mean, it's almost poetic, right? Because these landowners really are the stars of the show. Without their consent, without their willingness, without their love for conservation and ranching, which are the same thing in their mind, right? And they should be. We wouldn't even be having this conversation. But then you combine that with me, who's passionate about conservation, has a 30-year career with the feds, very little experience with the USDA, but lots with the U.S. Department of Interior, Fish and Wildlife Service, where I spent my entire career. But now chickens are listed under the Endangered Species Act, so I've got the credibility and experience to kind of come in with the landowners and say, hey, we've got overlapping values, there's opportunities, you want to collaborate? And the answer is yes. And so, yeah, so we get that letter back from the secretary saying, go talk to our state leaders. And at first, I was crushed. When I got that letter, I thought, oh, no, we're just being handed off. I really thought the Secretary of Agriculture was going to invite us into his office, sit us down and say, let me fix this for you.
Yeah.
but that's just not how it works. And, right. and it's, mm. it's it shouldn't be how that works, right? I mean, no one person, even the Secretary of Ag, should be so omnipotent as to just snap their fingers.
Yeah, and right.
And so where the action really happens within these USDA agencies is at the state leader level. And it should be. It's responsible to local politics, to local agricultural needs. Yeah. And so it was... And I knew just enough to embrace it, to love the process. And really, the outcomes of all those five different conversations in five different states was beautiful. It was so refined, so well targeted, so richly informed, and so collaborative. Mm-hmm. And now we've got advocates within both agencies, within both states saying, hey, you know, thanks for asking. You guys want to do more on our conservation title programs within the Farm Bill? Let's do this. And so it was so worth the exercise. And it's the kind of thing that the secretary couldn't, I mean, if the secretary took a whole bunch of his time, set it aside, and flew out to the southwestern Great Plains and worked on this for a couple months, he probably could have done it himself. Mm. But he doesn't have the time to do that.
Yeah.
And if we really care, then we need to show up and invest our time. And that's what we've done, and that's where we are.
Man. Yeah. So the lesser prairie chicken, the being on the endangered list, what does that practically mean for the landowners you work with?
Well, before you get to that, I have that as one of our talking points here. We need a status update. So last time we talked, it was, you had just written your article. I think it was titled Going Almost Gone. And you talked about how the federal government was, you, based on your experience, like you just mentioned, with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services, you felt that it was imminent that that designation was being handed down. I remember listening to that conversation on the Pheasants Forever podcast as well. Excuse me. And when did that designation eventually come through? Has it been a while now?
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. And was it just last year that was the final rule was published? And I think I'll say spring of last year.
Okay. Spring of 23.
Yeah. One of us should get on the Google and make sure I'm right about that.
That's you, Nicholas. That's you, Nicholas.
Okay. What am I Googling?
When? Lesser prairie
chicken final rule. It would be what the Fish and Wildlife Service jargon is. But let's say it was spring of last year. I almost think it was a year and a half ago.
November 2022.
Oh, okay. So even further back. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And I'm not sure if that was proposed or final rule. I forget, but roughly in there. That was the final rule. I don't know if that's when the final rule was published or if the listing took effect, which was, 60 days later, but it doesn't matter. So November 2022, the bird was listed. We'll just say that.
Did it feel like the feds kind of dragged their feet on getting that listing handed down, or did that feel like within the time frame that you thought was reasonable?
Well, there's two answers to that question. We won't go too far down the first path, but I'll just mention it. So the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is chronically underfunded, and they have statutory deadlines under the Endangered Species Act to make listing decisions. So environmental groups overwhelm the Fish and Wildlife Service's listing program with petitions to list, and the Fish and Wildlife Service cannot keep up physically. Then the environmental groups sue, saying you've missed your statutory deadline, which is true, so the service automatically loses.
Wow.
And so there's a court settlement that kind of proscribes a process for the service to go through this giant backlog of listing decisions. But it takes, you know, it's all driven by litigation, right? So so from that perspective, some would say the eight federal agencies dragged their feet. Really, they simply can't keep up because they lack the staff compared to the workload.
Yeah.
With lesser prairie chickens specifically, the Fish and Wildlife Service listed them back in 2014.
Okay.
So almost 10 years ago. And the court delisted it because they said that conservation programs were adequate. When clearly they've not been. And plain prairie habitat, as we all know, continues to go in the toilet.
Yep.
And so then the Fish and Wildlife Service got sued, petitioned again to list, missed the deadline, got sued. It went back on the list and became a higher priority because they're now so imperiled because so much time has gone by and they've not gotten the help that they need.
Man.
So that's the status update.
Well,
so
that's a good, I'm glad we asked, because there's a good lesson in there. You know, the example, it kind of reminds me of what happened in your state with wolves too, you know, where there was a management plan that was put in place when wolves were reintroduced. It got tied up in the courts. The state wasn't allowed to manage. The population grew to a point where, you know, they definitely needed management. And by that time, it was such an embittered thing. And it was like, what was it, like literally 20 years past due for like putting a management plan into practice that included, you know, population control and through hunting. And again, it's people who think that they have the right intention, but by bombarding the system like that, causes far more damage down the line.
Amen. And I hesitate to say this as a you cut me, I bleed type FWS blood. That's for U.S. I when I was 16 years old, I knew I wanted to be a biologist, but I never wanted to work for the government. My dad is a real political conservative, and so was I, right? So he told me the story made it okay to work for the government. I thought, well, I know these state fish and game agencies. Wouldn't it be cool if there was a federal fish and game? You know what? There is. And you know what? I spent my whole career working for them.
Yeah.
So, I am a blessed man, right?
Yeah.
So, but I'll have to say, when it comes to wolves, I'm glad Congress acted to delist them, because it was the right choice. I'm glad we're hunting now. It's, in my opinion, embarrassing how far we've gone to the extreme of killing wolves in the name of quote-unquote hunting. It's not fair chase. You can shoot them with night vision goggles and stuff. That's not me, but whatever. Yep. But sure. You're right. Yep. As an example, here's another example. People that think all trees are good everywhere all the time. And how does that impact rough grouse?
Yeah, that's fair.
And they're well-intentioned folks, right? Because clear-cutting for decades looked terrible, and people don't want to see that anymore. Well, it doesn't mean all trees are good everywhere all the time, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep, that's right.
Management. Anyway, well, I'm sorry.
Even the whole endangered prairie ecosystem, you know, one of the things that destroys a prairie are tree encroachment.
So right.
That's right. That's spot on. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, man, that was a good can of worms to kick things off with, Nicholas. Nicely done.
Okay. So I said the two things, right? The one, you know, the federal to drag their feet. Yep. It was really the court that delayed this a lot. And unfortunately, it's put us way behind, even further behind saving lesser prairie chickens now. But we're hoping now is the time. Spring of 2024 is the time when we're going to get full engagement from the Biden administration, to your question, Nick. And, you know, we're going to get some of the things that we're asking for to be able to help landowners conserve chickens.
So is it mostly you're looking for financial support for programs to be able to pay these landowners to have conservation, like CP25 is meant for pheasants in Iowa? Is that what you're looking for? Or?
Short answer is yes. Now, here's the thing. It's really interesting. These landowners, and I think most landowners in general, most farmers, ranchers, they do not want subsidies. They do not want cost share. They do not want incentives. They want to get paid fair market value for the ecosystem services that they provide, right? Mm-hmm. They get paid for the beef. Why don't they get paid for the healthy soil and the clean water and the clean air and the healthy vegetation and the wildlife and the hunting access and blah, blah, blah. You know, that's what they really want. But this markets exist for beef, but not for clean air or clean water.
Yeah.
And so consequently, we have these Farm Bill conservation title programs to help fill that gap, but they get distorted over time. And here's a perfect example with lesser prairie chickens. Today, the strongest remaining population of lesser prairie chickens remaining on the face of the planet are on 35-year-old CRP land in western Kansas. And the reason why is because at that time, the payment under CRP was enough that a landowner could pay the loan on the piece of land that they bought. And they said, that makes sense. I'll participate in that program. And they set it aside as native grassland, and we have chickens there still today because of it. That, in my opinion, is a worthwhile investment by the American public
in
these private lands. A great story, right? The offer for CRP in western Kansas today is less than what it was then.
Wow.
Who can afford to do that?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And so our first question is, hey, CRP in western Kansas 35 years ago, can't we just do that again? Isn't that a good idea still? So that's one ask, right?
Yeah.
And then you want to keep going on our asks here?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Yeah.
So another version of the ask is that the Biden administration, with a request from the governor of Wyoming, a Republican, implemented what they call a habitat leasing program for migration corridors in Wyoming. Maybe you've heard about it. And so in this program, they use farm bill dollars. They use grassland CRP to pay the landowner for an acre to set aside under grassland CRP. And then they come back to that same acre with their EQIP program and say, please treat invasive annual grasses here, which is a different outcome than the CRP payment, right? And makes sense. Well, so that's another example of what the Lesser Prairie Chicken Landowner Alliance is asking for in the southwestern Great Plains. Enroll us in grassland CRP, enroll us in EQIP, will restore native prairie habitats and protect them under the CRP provisions. Unfortunately, FSA has just made an internal decision that that was wrong and they can't do it. Now, we disagree. The Grouse Partnership, the Landowner Alliance, and many others disagree. In fact, there's court precedent on this. I just learned yesterday from one of our Lesser Prairie Chicken Landowner Alliance members who won on this point a few years back. That aside,
that's good.
And we're working on that. We're working on that. I just had a talk with one of our major national environmental groups. I just hung up from it 20 minutes ago before I got on the call with you guys, informing them of this court precedent. So we're working on it.
All right.
Yeah.
But that aside, there's a marker bill that may soon be introduced in Congress to address this via legislation. But the bottom line is, if we talked about this on your podcast last time, these landowners have to make a living. All they're asking is to be paid fair market value for the ecosystem services they're providing, and they're happy to provide. They're happy to grow lesser prairie chickens. They're happy to ensure clean water flowing off their land. But if their only way they can make money is to grow more cows, what are they going to do? They're going to grow more cows. Is that going to hurt chicken habitat? Probably will.
And so
we've got to pay enough dollars per acre somehow, either by going back to CRP payments 35 years ago, by combining payments under different programs like grassland CRP and EQIP, or some other means. We've got to be able to pay for the true cost and value of the resources these landowners are providing. That's the bottom line.
Yeah. Well, you know, factoring in with that, you mentioned the deal in Kansas. They were getting paid enough to make their land payment for those acres. Nicholas has been talking about this here recently, about this looming wealth transfer that's coming along. And a big part of that is, farmland. You know, there's a lot of landowners in our country are, you know, very, well into their senior years. And, how is that for not calling somebody old? They're you're far along into your senior years, but they're getting old, really old, nearing death, and we definitely see that here in Iowa, you know, and the cost for those to buy that land is exponentially higher than what it was 50 years ago. I mean, not even remotely close. And so the land payments that these old timers have been making are a fraction of what they're going to be for the next landowner, most likely. Yeah. And CRP is those acreage payments, I guess we could say, are going to have to be much greater to be able to justify it to the new landowners.
So American public, what do we want?
And we
echo what essentially you've said, you know, if reading between the lines here in our conversation, it's great if we don't have to have the government make this happen by just, you know, for instance, what if the government just put an excise tax on beef and pork and anything else that's, you know, this is to reward the landowner for using good conservation practices. That would be one way to do it. But a better way to do it would be if, as consumers, we would just say, you know what, we're willing to pay for better quality and better farming practices, husbandry practices, with livestock, knowing that those practices do better for habitat, do better for water quality, air quality, soil quality, everything, you know, That would be the best way.
Ted, can I ask a couple devil advocate questions?
Yeah.
I don't want you to feel like, because I agree with you on this point, but we've interviewed someone who in some sections of agriculture would argue this, and I just want to hear what you have to say about it. And this was about row crop, but their point on row crop was that the landowner was putting on too much nitrogen. They knew they were doing too much nitrogen, or it was just negligence. They weren't doing their homework on how much the nitrogen was running into the water, and then they were expecting the public to pay for that nitrogen runoff with prairie strips or something like that. So his whole argument, he seemed frustrated, because most people we talked to are like, it's not really the landowner's fault, you know, there's other, but he was kind of like, no, like the landowners are doing stupid stuff and they're wanting us to pay for it. Now I tend to lean your way. I want the public to pay for things that we want, but I'm just curious what your thoughts are on kind of his statement or his idea.
Well, there's truth to all sides. And so like in that example, you know, this happens on people's domestic lawns that live, you know, mm-hmm. on a lakeshore property. And they put too much fertilizer on their grass and it washes into the lake. And so their neighbor does it, and their other neighbor does it, and their other neighbor does it. And pretty soon the water quality of the lake is poor in midsummer and everyone's upset. Well, mm-hmm. whose fault is it? Everyone's who puts on, you know, what do you do?
Yeah,
yeah. It, right. And, yeah. and so, but that's the whole point about subsidies, cost share, and incentives, government subsidies distort markets.
Mm-hmm.
If we, the American public, really want to sequester carbon via grasslands, if we really want to save the lesser prairie chickens from extinction, if we really want clean air and clean water, then let's find a way to pay for it. And the healthiest, best way to pay for it in the American experience is through to let capitalism dictate the costs and benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. that's what landowners say. Now, is that doesn't exist today, and these landowners know it. You know what does exist? Farm Bill conservation title programs mm-hmm. and oodles of dollars under the Inflation Reduction Act and the bipartisan infrastructure law that are falling out of the pockets of these federal agencies. So what they're saying now is, look, let's use this extra money in a focused way, and let's use it to develop these markets. Let's stop distorting markets. Let's stop giving landowners 50% of what it really costs to provide clean air and clean water and healthy habitats and expect them to pay for the rest out of their pocket.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's figure out what the true costs are and how we can move from the moment in time we are now, where we actually have public funds to pay for these things right away yeah. and use it to develop these private markets in the future, and who pays and how. And I'll tell yeah. you right now, there are already private companies paying at least one of the Lesser Prairie Chicken Landowner Alliance members money to grow Lesser Prairie chickens.
Wow.
So there's already a nascent market that is emerging in the form of a mitigation program for oil and gas companies that impact lesser prairie chicken habitat,
kind of like a carbon credit but for chickens.
Yeah.
A chicken
yeah.
credit.
Yeah.
We need to start chicken credit company, Ken.
Yes, that's what this person is doing. You should talk to them. It's a neat group.
That is brilliant. Yeah, we'd love to chat with them. So I love that. Do you have because I like the idea of the world's health, not just like bodily health, but the health of our ecology and things like that.
Yeah.
I like the idea of that going better, but usually the solutions we hear are more government. And
that's right.
I don't like the idea of more government. Do you?
Nobody does.
Right? Well,
maybe
yeah.
some do, but I don't either.
But do you have, even if they're like way like shot at the moon, like ideas, do you have any ideas on, cause I feel like we get caught in the system where like, well, who's going to pay us? I guess the government's going to need to pay us. You know, do you have any ideas, even if you think they wouldn't happen for 50 years?
Well, carbon credits, endangered species credits are two of them right off the top.
I like that. Endangered species credits. I like that.
Yeah. Until this conversation, I'd never heard of that.
Well, wetlands credits, right? You've heard of wetland banking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we've done it.
Mm-hmm.
We've done it in other forms, and we're currently doing it with lesser prairie chickens in a very nascent manner. But, you know, it's we can do this. We're America. We're the king of capitalists. Come on. We can figure this out.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
We've done it before.
I think you know, people and millennials and Gen Zers, for all of our faults, where we, and especially with my friends and as my friends are having kids and they're thinking about it more, even, you know, fourth generation farmers that I'm friends with are kind of being like, something, it always starts with food. Like, yeah, something's not right with their food. And then one of two things: they either start making their own bread or they start making their own soap. Chickens in their backyard, and then they say, "I'm going to homeschool my kids." Yeah. And then after they homeschool their kids, you know, they start listening to Jordan Peterson or something like that. And, you know, that it's all from there. But the whole point being that we're kind of waking up and like, oh, like voting with my dollar, you know, is becoming a big deal. It's the cheapest isn't the best at this point, because we can, maybe that was the case, you know, 600 years ago, where you didn't have option to have plastic in your water. But now we're kind of like, we, you know, things have gotten so cheap that we're like, maybe there's a limit to how cheap we should let things get, or how many corners we allow to cut.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We, you know, Winston Churchill years ago, Americans get the government they deserve.
Mm.
And that's for better or worse. Right. And we grow our own chickens now. I hope we look back on this era in human history 50 years from now, when it comes to two things, pharmaceuticals and our food industry. I hope we look back 50 years from now and think, what the hell were we thinking?
Yeah.
Putting that stuff in our bodies. Just last night on the evening news, on NBC News, national news, there was a story about heroin-like addictive drugs in energy drinks and in convenience stores around the country. And the FDA came out, learned about this, the addictive qualities, came out and said, we recommend they be pulled from shelves. What the hell?
Yeah.
Is that
all?
That's government regulation. Yeah. But so I guess maybe you need both. I don't know. But my point is, I totally agree. Right now, it's an every person for themselves. That's why we have our own chickens and grow our own eggs. And that's why I shoot an elk every year. And 2 years ago, I shot a moose. We're still eating my moose. Because I don't want to buy store-bought meat with hormones in it.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Hey, well, I guess he'd be really far from it. But we just talked to a pig farmer who is starting to do it true and pure regenerative agriculture. And his pigs are totally grass-fed, you know, and they, like, hang out in the woods, you know, near. And he's just got
acorns.
And now that'd be a long ways to ship meat. But, you know, I think people are starting to get it. Now, here's where people are willing. I'm just thinking about this now. People are kind of willing to open their wallets at this point. But people, it's going to be a slower process for people to turn away from their livelihood. You know, it's one thing to dish out an extra 10% out of your wallet. It's another thing to be like, I will change my identity for what I do as a human, you know.
And that happens within the Alaska Prairie Chicken Landowner Alliance. There are some ranchers that are more willing to graze fewer cows for the long-term health of their land and stability of their income. There's other ranchers that's the only income they've got, and come a drought year or not, they got to raise X number of cows.
Mm.
And then that causes the land to pay the price. So I don't know. And that's why if you have markets, those landowners probably have a different price point for what they would want for selling their clean water credits or endangered species credits, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the way it should be. And a one-size-fits-all of a government subsidies program isn't going to have the same effectiveness.
Yeah, because if you're at the grocery store and you see a package that says beef friendly for lesser prairie chicken, you're like, what the heck does that even mean? They're just raising that price for no reason. You know, it's really hard for consumers to even know what is important on those labels. You know, what? Why does it matter where it was raised or what it was fed? Or
I think culturally we've done a good job. I mean, obviously we're speaking, you know, I got to be careful here because we're in like unprecedented, you know, debt right now as a nation. But, you know, I think on an individual basis, we've done a pretty good job teaching people the value of money as far as, hey, if you blow all your money, you're going to be broke. And so people have more or less gotten the picture that I got to be wise with my money. But what we haven't done a good job of is teaching people but there are some things that you spend more money on for the sake of quality. And so we just teach frugality, but we do not teach value. And yes. And I think yeah. that's really what we're, you know, if there's an opposition right now, an opposing mindset, that's one of the biggest ones that we're fighting with. You know, one of the things Carol jokes with me about sometimes is we're big Dutch heritage around here. In fact, we're very close to the town of Pella, Iowa. I don't know if you're familiar with Pella, Ted, but they have the big tulip festival. You're not allowed to own a business in Pella, right, Nicholas, without a Dutch storefront, something like that.
Yeah, or Dutch last name. Yeah.
So even like McDonald's, you know. But But you know, we'll be like cleaning out a combine and I'll be like, oh, here, we got this little bit. I can reach way in there, Carol, and I can scoop this out. And I'll be like, oh, that's too Dutch, you know? And, you know, there's like, but there, it's that same concept. And I think that that even transfers over then to how land is used. You know, farmers around here view a, you know, just for, to say, hey, could you just leave that land, those acres set aside because it's better for, you know, water quality, air quality, soil quality, wildlife habitat.
It's bad to, business.
Well, not just that. It's even to a point of bad stewardship, right? I'm not using, I am not maximizing what I've been given. That is a form of me not getting, you know, my money's worth. And I think that's where the education has to really shift that would address a lot of these problems is, no, there's a different value there. We talk about all the time, Nicholas, you got to see value beyond the dollar. And sometimes you got to see the value of, okay, but how many dollars get me a better thing, you know? And I think there's that side of value that we have to see as well.
You know, and I'm going to speak to that. In the context of, as an endangered species biologist, I worked a lot with major companies like timber companies and mining companies and oil and gas. And again, being, you know, born a political conservative, I am maybe better able to see through the eyes of some of these companies. And you know what? People who run those companies, they're people too. They're people with children. They're people who want their children to drink clean water and eat healthy food just like us, right? And I remember learning over the years that these companies have a fiduciary obligation to their shareholders. Their job is to make money for their shareholders. So while they can be good corporate citizens to an extent, and they can advertise and they say, hey, we have a slice of this budget, you know, 2% that we use to do good things in communities. Well, if they go over that 2%, they can be sued by their shareholders for failing to fulfill their fiduciary obligations to the shareholders. You're wasting our money giving it away for goody two shoes projects. And that had just never occurred to me to think of it that
way. That's a great point. That is a great
point. And so your farmers there who, you know, farm that last back corner because it's good stewardship, they have a fiduciary obligation to their children to buy healthy food, pay more money to buy healthy food, right?
Right, yeah.
Under the college. And so it's that's why, you know, markets are good. Fair, free, you know, free trade is good. And we need to shape it in a way that makes sure it and embraces all of our values. And for ranchers in America right now, they get, there's a market for beef. There's not a market for all of the other things that they and we care about.
Right.
There's not a market for clean water and endangered species. And because of it, we're losing all of our prairies and our prairie habitats and all of the ecosystem services that come with prairies.
Yeah, that was so
well said. It's the choice we've made. Yeah.
That was so That's well said.
Why it comes back to the consumer. So corporations, if consumers said, hey, we care about this thing, corporations would be like, okay, cool. We'll do those then.
As long as the playing field is level, as long as every corporation has to participate in that market with the same costs of participating in that market, fine. They'll raise their cost an extra 5 cents a pound or whatever they're selling. And, you know, us consumers pay it. And then that extra 5 cents goes to paying for clean air and endangered species and all those things that we want. And it's better than a subsidies program. Subsidies program, you know, they start out well designed and well intentioned. And 35 years later, they're totally missing the mark.
Mm. Yeah. Yep. Mm. Yeah. That's very well said. And it's so important that we think of it from that standpoint too, because, if there's a criticism that I think can exist, and we've honestly seen this too, from being a native seed producer, there's other wrinkles within the prairie industry, we'll say, who expect less of the cheap species, right? The kind of species that are like the everyone gets used to, right? Black-eyed Susan, common milkweed, big blue stem, and everyone's got that. You know, we need you producers to grow more of the really expensive species, but also please offer them at much more affordable prices, because then we'll have and
yeah, that thing you had to wake up at 3 a.m. to make sure you could hand collect before you dropped
right
on the ground.
Right.
If that could be cheaper, that would be good.
Right. Yeah. And what it is it's like, it's a symptom of not really looking at the full picture. And, we're never going to be perfect with that, of course. And some of those pie in the sky ideas are good for us to hear too, because there's some truth in those pie in the sky ideas. Yeah. Maybe if we could find a way to make something more affordable, it would provide benefits in this way. So how can we creatively look at lowering the cost of our inputs to make that bottom line better, you know, for the consumer? So it's not something that, you know, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, I guess is what I'm saying. But also, if the opposition, right, quote unquote opposition, sees that we're making a conscientious effort to see things from their shoes, then they're gonna hear us out, I think, more often instead of writing us off. And so I think it's really important to stay grounded as a conservation community, with having reasonable solutions that help and don't just write people off, you know, at the same time.
Yeah. I think there's environmental groups that look at, you know, any rancher is a bad rancher.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's just not true. Do you wear leather shoes? Do you wear a leather belt? Do you eat meat? Yeah, give me a break. Yeah. You're part of the problem too, buddy.
Yeah.
And so, the most efficient way to find the cheapest price is through a market, right? That's what I believe. That's what the Lesser Burgic and Landowner Alliance believes. Do we need government's help to structure the market? Yes, we do. Does it need to be regulation? Does it need to be incentives? Does it need to be a, you know, carbon credit transfer market? I don't know. I'm not smart enough. I mean, I don't know these things, but I do know that we all need to come together. And I'll say this, you know, between the Lesser Prairie Chicken Landowner Alliance, all these ranchers, and our Prairie Grouse partner groups, which includes groups like the National Wildlife Federation, which is, I don't know, in my view, pretty far left, you know, I mean, not extreme, but they're on that side, but they're all together in this. And so, and then we talked to every agency employee and the Biden administration officials, we got nothing but positive responses. So when you were talking about those in opposition, right now, where I stand, what I'm working on, I hate to say this because I'm gonna get a phone call as soon as I hang out. I hate what you do, but we've yet to find our opposition, because we're probably, we're embracing, you know, conservative values of markets and private property rights and ranching and conserving endangered species all in the same acre.
I don't know.
Hard to hate that. You have to work real hard to hate that.
Yeah. Lucky to do what I do.
Yeah. Man. Yeah. That's good. That's a good mindset to have.
You had alluded to, it seemed like you were alluding to CRP kind of being a good program, but missing the mark now. What would you change? Is it just like the amount of the payments or?
Yeah.
Okay.
The bottom line for these landowners is more dollars per acre.
Mm-hmm.
They can't afford to subsidize endangered species recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And the Endangered Species Act says endangered species are of value to all Americans, and the federal government should use its resources to promote the conservation of endangered species. These landowners are saying, okay, put your money where your mouth is. And by the way, don't regulate me at the same time. You know, one of the big fears of the endangered species listings is regulation.
Yeah.
These landowners are saying, we're more than willing to have chickens, but one, don't regulate us, and two, make sure we're getting paid to grow chickens just like we get paid to grow beef.
Mm-hmm.
Why should it be any different?
What kind of regulation are they worried about? I guess I'm not
Oh, they're worried about the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service coming in and saying, you can't grow, you know, graze cows here on your private land.
Oh, yeah.
Or you have to reduce the number of cows on your private land because you're eating too much grass. Mm-hmm. And it could end up going that way. What usually happens is it's not the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that does it, but there's a citizen's suit provision in the Endangered Species Act where an environmental group could drive down the county road, look over the fence, and say, well, we know chickens live here, and this guy's grazed his grass down to the nubbins in this drought year. Let's sue him. And they could sue, and they might win.
Mm, yeah.
And that's an outcome we don't want.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we got money falling out of the USDA agency's pockets right now, and we want to the best defense is a good offense.
Yeah.
The best way to not get regulated is to have healthy habitats, which is what every one of these landowners wants, to have healthy chicken populations and healthy livestock populations.
Yeah.
We can do it. We have the tools. Yeah. We've got the funding. Let's just do that.
Yeah, I think one way, and we need to, we've been trying hard on this. We've talked about it for a long time, Nicholas. We're trying to find somebody who really understands ag subsidies well.
Yeah.
Talk about it's how that,
hard.
It's very hard. We've found, I found one guy that I reached out to, I haven't heard back from yet. But we're going to find somebody eventually because it is a super important thing that I think all Americans need to understand.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of money that is used in controlling commodity prices, in crop insurance, and you know, there's some of that money that we're not saying should be taken out of farmers or ranchers' pockets. We're just saying let's give them that money still. Fine. But let's actually get something out of it. So if we're insuring acres that shouldn't be cropped, we're not saying don't okay, you can't crop those acres anymore. And by the way, we're taking this insurance money away that your operation needs. Just give them the money and say, hey, don't crop those acres. Here's the money still for not cropping them. Please plant, you know, some kind of native habitat there, whether it be forest, grassland, wetland, whatever. To your point, those monies, there's a legalese term for you, monies. My youngest daughter, whenever she says the word mine, like that's mine, she says that's mines. It's like one of the cutest things she says, the plural of mine. But those monies, they exist, I think, and could be just restructured how they're handed over. And we could achieve all these things, just by changing how that money is used.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned an expert on ag subsidies. I mean, the Lesser Prairie Chicken Landowner Alliance members would say ag subsidies suck.
Mm-hmm.
Well-intended. They work sometimes some places for a while,
mm-hmm.
but given the lack of market forces shaping them over time, eventually they become distorted.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we could simply create a system where it says, you know, a landowner might lease their land to somebody else to row crop it. They mm-hmm. might lease it to somebody else to graze it. They might lease it to somebody else to hunt it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yep. How about if they lease it to somebody else to grow lesser prairie chickens or to grow, you know, to generate mm-hmm. clean water and clean air and healthy soils and healthy native grasslands? Why can't that be the conversation? Mm-hmm. Why does it have to be about subsidies?
Yeah.
That's the mindset we need to get into, or else all of these are band-aids. They're unsustainable fixes because over time they'll become distorted and unhelpful.
Yeah.
That's my core political belief.
I think it's a great out of the box way of looking at it.
Yeah. But what you see here in Iowa, at least, is people get paid about $100 less for CRP an acre than they would in rent, which immediately, you know, $10 less, you're kind of like, okay, what's the difference? $100, you know, that's 30%. Yeah. That's, you know, that's the difference between getting your kids braces or not, you know, and quite a bit more. Well, so there's a lot of missed opportunity there as well. But then also we got to remember that the CRP is not even close to paying a mortgage.
And right. and in Iowa, you know, you're ranging anywhere. Cheap farmland would be $8,000, $9,000 mm-hmm. an acre, and expensive stuff's $20,000. And now I'm not saying that we need to make sure that the most expensive mortgages get paid. You know, that it's probably that price for a reason. Maybe it's great corn mm-hmm. ground. Great, leave that to great corn ground. But if it's got like a really crappy CSR, I like just pay them what they have to pay the mortgage and CRP payments. You know, at least that, which is double what we currently pay for CRP. And I, like you were saying earlier, I think it just shows what we care about, what our society like thinks is important. We're putting our money there, and that's a very difficult thing to tackle. And you are one, and I talked to a lot of conservationists. You're one of the few people I've ever had a conversation with that is doing something, moving the needle in a way that it can be seen. There are tons of heroes out there that are paying attention to how they're spending their dollar. They're growing a little bit of pollinator in their yard, and it's not useless. But frankly, you can't see the needle moved on one yard with pollinator. You need thousands and thousands and thousands of yards. But, or you just need one Ted Cook, you know? And I'm not saying you're doing it. There's tons of people helping you, but still, like, you're moving the needle in a direction needs to go. And that is, it's wild to me to see that, because I feel like Kent and I are doing a good job for conservation, and still I feel like the needle just is hardly moving. But,
you know, so grousepartners.org.
Yeah.
But let me say to that, when I got hired in the interview, one of the board members said, we're, you know, a small but mighty 501c3, you know, organization. And what we want to do is move the needle. And man, I have, every morning I wake up and I think, how am I going to move the needle? And I'll tell you, I'm a 14-hour a week employee now.
Wow.
Honestly, I work more than that, but that's, we are truly small and mighty. And then we have a part-time communications director. She's 20 hours a week. She's awesome.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. But we're looking to grow this year. So seriously, we need the help. Nicholas, I really want to speak to the CRP thing. Just the language you were using there strikes me. And I'm farm bill program ignorant. Every conversation about farm bill, I'm always the dumbest guy in the room. But I'll just observe this. When you talked about CRP, you said pay them to not farm it. Pay them to mm-hmm. not do whatever. Mm-hmm. Then the whole dynamic is you're getting a subsidy to sit on your couch, Mr. Agriculturalist.
Mm, mm,
and that's yeah. just not the right way to, I know nothing. I'm not a part of this world. That just feels wrong in my core. Mm-hmm. CRP should be, we want to pay you, Mr. Agriculturalist, to give us X pounds of soil conservation and native prairie growth and clean water mm-hmm. and clean air and carbon sequestration. And here's how much we'll pay for those amounts of those ecosystem services that you will provide if you don't farm this. Will you give us those services for X dollars? Yes, I will. That's mm-hmm. got to be the conversation. Otherwise, I don't understand how to think about paying someone to not do something.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But it's like the mafia. It's like, you pay me to not burn down your house. You
know? Oh, my God. Oh, that's such a, I need a minute to recover. Yeah. But you're right. I mean, can we talk about it in more positive, proactive, solution-oriented terms? That's my frustration.
I'm going to do that. I'm going to start talking about it like that. We need to pay them to do this.
Yes.
To do this.
To provide these public fair. Value.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then it's not viewed, because the other way that it's viewed, so that's kind of the negative way that it can be used. The positive language that you usually hear is, "Oh, let's give these farmers a carrot to do the right thing." And that's not the right way to do it either. Let's
pay them a truckload of carrots to do
that's demeaning. That's demeaning. Yeah.
Right, it is.
Well, these landowners should really be doing the right thing, but we'll throw them a couple of pennies to try to encourage them. No.
Right.
They grow a lot of value for Americans. They only get paid for very few of those values.
How do you even put a price tag on the value of not polluting water to
clean water, to keep water clean.
Yeah. So there's all sorts of science out there about percent ground cover of various types of vegetation, you know, native vegetation, like grasslands and forest lands, and the degree to which you reduce mobilization of soil plus agricultural chemicals. We talked earlier about nitrogen, you know, setting aside the right acres in the right places can provide a nitrogen buffer to help keep water clean. There's math that goes with all of those values.
Mm-hmm.
There's even math that goes with growing a lesser prairie chicken. And that's what this one company is doing, selling conservation credits to oil and gas companies to turn around and pay private landowners to grow more chickens, which is happening as we speak. There's even math that there are dollar amounts being generated from science around the question of how much is that worth?
Mm-hmm.
That is not a challenge. I mean, you know, again, markets will dictate this and science will rise and fall to meet the occasion. And one person's science, it won't be the same as another person, but that becomes part of the dialogue, right? Part of the debate. Yeah. Then you get a lot better, more high quality science to inform and answer those questions so that markets can base economic decisions on those data. But those data already exist. We can do this.
Wow. I did not know that.
Sure.
Yeah. That's so handy.
Yeah.
You can calculate the number of the amount of carbon that can be sequestered per acre of native grassland versus other.
Oh, Ted, you want to hear something so sad? I was so sad about this. So on your word of talking about carbon, we talked about carbon last time we chatted. We were like, yeah, why aren't we applying for carbon credits? Look at all this carbon we're capturing. So I reached out to some carbon companies and they were all like, yeah, like you're doing a really good thing. The problem is we would pay you to make a difference. And so since you're already doing it, there's no difference. Isn't that sad?
I am so glad you brought this up. I am so glad you brought this up. Isn't that a shame?
Mm-hmm.
You are doing the right thing. Therefore, we can't support you.
Yep.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, how? And so here's the other thing is some people will say, you know, in Farm Bill Conservation Title programs, oh, we already paid them, you know, last year to grow fewer cows. You know, why should we pay them again this year? And my answer is, well, you paid them last year to buy a steak and you ate it. Why should you have to pay them again this year for a steak? Because it's a new freaking steak.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah.
There should be an ongoing benefit to providing those ecosystem services.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know what the incentive is? For you to break it out, grow row crops for 3 years or however, whatever the statute of limitations is, so that you can then come back and get a CRP payment for putting it back into the condition it already is.
Yeah. Till it up every year twice, get all that carbon out of there. Yeah.
Subsidies, cost shares, incentives are wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Fair market value for ecosystem services. You are providing ecosystem services. You are providing carbon sequestration as we speak. You should be able to access markets to pay you to do so.
Mm. Yeah.
That's a sign of why it's broke. Why we're broken right now.
Any chance you found a company that pays for that?
No.
Well, you know what this makes me think of actually is our friend Doug Duren with Sharing the Land. It was just something I noticed. Since I started working here, Carol has built a pheasant hunter's paradise out here. Right, we have hundreds of acres of prairie for people to come out and hunt pheasants. And people drive by, they notice that, wow, there's all that pheasant habitat we haven't seen anywhere else around here.
Yeah.
And then they knock on the door. And because Carol's a super nice guy, he lets most people come out here, no strings attached, other than, you know, don't act like an idiot because then I'll never let you come back. They've put zero time, zero effort, zero money even into anything that takes place out here. And then they come and reap the benefit because he's a nice guy and he lets them come and do that. And what Doug has said is access has value. And if you want to come and hunt my place, great. What do I get out of it as a landowner? And more importantly, what does the land get out of it from you using it?
Mm-hmm.
And Sharing the Land has essentially done this. Now, when there's still a lot of guys that came out here and hunted this year, but they either got handed a Sharing the Land pamphlet, like, hey, just so you know, this is how we do things now. We understand that because this is new, you may not know it yet. So you can either, you know, come and be a part of our leasing options that we have for a hunt, or you can come and join Sharing the Land and come and, you know, trade us some of your efforts to help our farm work. And we'll let you come out here and have a great time pheasant hunting. And I was very happy to see that happen, because I feel like Carol is finally getting something back for what has taken four decades to build.
Yeah.
And it's the same, it's just a small scale thing that illustrates the much larger concept that you're pointing at, is we can't just view these. Yes, I hope we continue to view the wildlife as a publicly owned thing, right? But we can't view that as, they just so happened, this publicly owned thing just so happens to be on your land. Please keep it that way. We have to say, no, this publicly owned thing that we all value greatly likes being on your land. How can we make it so that you will keep your land?
That's right.
And make sense.
That's a great story. No, and that's exactly how it should be. There's a person who wants to provide those values, and there's people out there that are willing to pay for those values. And so let's make sure that there's a market or a set of conditions that allows that to be successful. Yeah.
Mm. Yep.
You should connect with Doug Duren, because I bet the Landowners Alliance, I bet there'd be a lot of overlap with the Sharing the Land and just the vision that he's got. He does a really good job casting it. Mm-hmm.
I
think you're right. There's people, I mean, you know, the members of the Lesser Prairie Chicken Landowner Alliance are awesome humans, and awesome humans exist all over the planet, including in agricultural communities across the Great Plains.
Yeah.
In fact, I worked with an awesome group of humans in northern Nevada and sage-grouse country who are a lot like my Lesser Prairie Chicken Landowner Alliance friends. And I know, it just seems like these awesome humans, if you could get them all together somehow, they would get along fabulously, and they could change the future of prairie habitats, I'll bet.
Yeah, my palms get a little sweaty when I start thinking about that, when we're at like Pheasant Fest or the North American Prairie Conference. Like, man, if somebody was really out to get grassland conservation, this would be the place. Everyone that cares in the whole world is right here under this roof. Dude, we are so vulnerable.
And isn't that a beautiful thing? I mean, I just, first time I went to Pheasant Fest, I'm like, I didn't realize there were 30,000 other people that loves prairies.
Yes.
Yeah.
I know it. I know it's such a great, amazing, great thing. Well, as we draw near an end here, Ted, you know, I cracked open my, one of my New Year's resolutions has been less screen time, and I've been doing very well. Thank you very much.
Down
Nicholas.
To 6 hours a day.
Yeah. It's incredible. Right. No, actually. I'm doing very well. So I've been reading much more print material, and I cracked open my quarterly, I think it's a quarterly, from BHA, Backcountry Hunters and Anglers.
Oh, you told me this story. You were on the toilet hiding from your kids.
No, but that is a great place to hide from the kids.
That's a lot of detail to the story.
Wow. So I open up the quarterly, first page right there. I see this familiar face, and it is the face of our guest today, Mr. Ted Cook. And I'm like, that's Ted. And you had this whole article about, and it was, I loved the style of the article about how a kid grows up and becomes this new adult eventually that you get to have a good friendship with, and all the times they said they hated you when they were in the awkward teenage years can be forgotten, and all the days where they thought you were Superman when they were seven can still be reminisced about. And you know, like you did, I like how you structured that article to talk about the growth of BHA, and it was just, so I wanted to bring that up in here, as that was awesome, and I'm glad to hear that you're on that board for you know, helping a great organization that's doing a lot of good work in a lot of the areas that we've talked about through this conversation. But then I just started thinking, I was like, man, Ted's involved in that. I knew you had the long career with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services. Obviously, your role at North American
Grouse Partnership.
Yes, Grouse Partnership. I almost said friendship. Grouse Partnership.
And that applies.
So North American Grouse Partnership. And I think, weren't you like on with a herpetological society at one time too?
Yeah, I used to be president of the Idaho Herpetological Society. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like Ted has done all this awesome stuff. And you've done so much work as a conservationist. What's your next move? Like, as a lifelong conservationist, I'm not saying you got to like make some big announcement here, but like you've built a legacy, but as you continue on in that next phase of leaving a legacy behind as a conservationist, what's some like unfinished business you kind of would like to see done as you continue through your career?
Great question. Right now I'm all in on North American Grouse Partnership work and moving the needle, you know, as you said, Nicholas, on trying to pay fair market value for ecosystem services and save our prairie habitats, which, as your listeners may know, prairies are the most threatened ecosystem type on the continent, mm-hmm. and in fact, in the world. Mm-hmm. And so even though right now we're looking to get a full-time executive director for the North American Grouse Partnership, that full-time person will not be Ted Cook. Because I'm retired, or my wife and my brothers have fired me from the ranks of retirement. So if we're fortunate enough to grow as an organization, the Grouse Partnership, we need to raise about $300,000 in 2024 to do it. And we have our sights set at about $100,000 of that. We need to triple that here in the next 11 months. But I'd still like to stay with the organization and keep driving this ship on lesser prairie chickens. But a new executive director would grow that out. We don't care just about lesser prairie chickens or just southwestern Great Plains. We think that the principles that we're seeking to apply in lesser prairie chicken country could and should apply everywhere across the planet. And what we want to do is create a model for others to follow. I mean, that's where we're seeking to work with the Biden administration to help begin to create that model so we can then make it work here in export. Beyond that, though, I'll say... really, what I've been thinking about more is, one, spending more time actually being retired. My wife and I just built our forever home in Garden Valley, an hour north of Boise, Idaho.
Congratulations.
And thank you. We're learning to become agriculturalists. We've got our gateway livestock chickens already. And,
come on.
I love it.
More to come. But really, within Idaho, I really want to support the hunting and angling community here. And, you know, you brought up wolves earlier. And so one of the things I did in my career is, when I worked for the Fish and Wildlife Service in Idaho, as I led wolf reintroduction here. Mm-hmm. And I always told myself that wolves would not be fully recovered until I could go to the Idaho Department of Fish and Game, buy a wolf tag, and shoot one. Mm-hmm. Now, right now, honestly, my interest in shooting a wolf is low because the hatred projected towards wolves by a small group of hunters in Idaho is so great that I don't want to be associated with them. Mm-hmm. I love wolves. I love elk. I love butterflies. I love trout.
mm-hmm. yep.
I love all wildlife, and I don't hate any of them. They're all God's creatures. And so, honestly, I'd like to focus my efforts within the state of Idaho to try to calm folks down, return wolves to the status of a game species, just like every other game animal, and the rules of fair chase applying equally to wolves and everything else. And when that happens, then I'm going to go wolf hunting with my recurve, and I'm going to... It'll take me probably till the day I die, but I'd love to take a wolf with my recurve.
That'd be awesome.
Fair chase principles. So that's one vision for my future. How's that?
Wow.
I love it. Great way to finish this one out. And Ted, we need to do this every single year. We waited too long in between the last one and this one. But I always just feel so good afterwards. And it's encouraging to talk with a guy like you who's got a lot of positive not just thoughts, but strategies and plans and real practical stuff that could be applied if enough people get on board with it. And that positivity is infectious, and it keeps us grounded here too on our end of prairie reconstruction and saving this endangered landscape. And I think we're going to get there. Might be long after the three of us are gone, but knowing that we could play a small part in it along the way, all of us as teammates in our various spheres, that's a pretty powerful thing, and that's a thing that helps me sleep well at night.
Yeah, man, Ted. Well, I want to talk to our listeners directly here. We're not a nonprofit. If you want to support us, you can buy some of our products, or you know, buy merch or something of the sort. But North American Grouse Partnership, are you guys officially a 501c3?
Yes.
So the 501c3. So if you're really worried about, you know, your taxes, you can give them money. But here's the deal about them. We interview a lot of people who are involved with a lot of different 501c3s, and I hear a lot, well, yeah, I'll give them a little money. They're a good cause. There's a lot of good causes out there. Mm. And friends, there's not a lot of good causes that are backed by people that get crapped on. And Ted is showing that he gets crap done. He's moving the needle. He's talking to the right people, not just on the high level, but on the low level. He's really connected with the landowners. And we like them. And we have never done this before. We've never said this. But if you're like trying to donate, let's go hang out with North American Grouse Partnership. Let's put a little money where our mouth is. And we understand that most of our listeners are in the Midwest, and there's very little overlap with Ted's area, but it will have huge ramifications if what they're pushing in the farm bill and what they're pushing for landowners in that area, it would have huge ramifications for the Midwest. I mean, huge. And even farmers, if you're wanting to get fair dollars for the acres you're setting aside for the rest of the public,
or even just the practices you're adopting.
Yeah, $300,000. What is that? That's like a few dollars per listener on our place. You know, if you've got an extra $20 sitting aside, why don't you go hang out? Ted did not ask us to do this. I didn't even talk to Kent about doing this.
No,
I thought
Nicholas was going to preach. I thought that's what he was doing, which he kind of is right now.
Yeah.
He's like a televangelist. You know, feel guilty.
But we're not
give me your money to feel better.
Yeah. No, I'm just kidding. No. I just wanted to emphasize that not only is it a good cause, but your dollars will help move the needle. So,
yeah, well said.
Well, you guys, I said this right before we got in there, but your hearts are pure and beautiful, and your intellect and your passion. I will talk to you every day of the week if you want.
Oh, appreciate that. That means a lot to us.
The fact that you guys are growing native seed to support prairie restoration is one of the most fundamentally important things we can do. And I wish you Godspeed for all of that. And I just know from who you are that those who listen to your podcast are prairie lovers too. And amen. Bless you to all of you. Hopefully I'll see some of you at Pheasant Fest. That's a confab of 30,000 of the world's most passionate prairie lovers. North American Grouse Partnership, we're going to keep you in what we're doing, and look forward to seeing you guys soon and talking to you some more.
Thanks for having me. Yeah. Yep.
Thank you, Ted. And thank you to all of our listeners. Please remember the podcast is presented by Hoxie Native Seeds. If you want to know how to become a member of North American Grouse Partnership, we'll share a link in the show notes. Please click there and get on board with a membership. And like Nick said, if you'd like to make a donation, you could reach out to them. I'm sure they can point you in the right direction for that. And until next time, share this podcast with those around you. Please leave a 5-star review if you think we're worth it. The more people that hear this podcast, the more minds we change. And that's important because conservation happens one mind at a time.